Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
November, knocking on the door or already inside and making itself at home. It depends on when you're listening, whatever. But here we are with JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. We have a number of SPGN educational offerings to remind you about. There's the Winter School on Basic Science and Translational Research. Well, it's coming up, and on the 15th of this month, there's a work on transition from pediatric to adult healthcare in patients with GI or liver disease. And on the 21st of this month, there's the 9th IBD Masterclass. But getting back to what we have on board today, Jake has chosen, let me make sure I've got this squared away. Jake has chosen an article from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Buhuis et al. Lateral flow test versus enzyme-linked immunoabsorbent assay to measure infliximab trough concentrations, a head-to-head comparison. And from Nature Medicine by Huang et al., lipid profiling identifies modifiable signatures of cardiometabolic risk in children and adolescents with obesity. We learned from the JPGN article that lateral flow testing results closely match those of the present standard of measurement and are much more quickly obtained, which may allow earlier intervention in an inflammatory disease flare. And we learn from Huang et al. That the lipidome is of enriched, that the lipidome of obese children is enriched in species associated with increased disease risk. Well, that's to be expected, but what's of interest is that enrichment can be reversed with non-pharmacologic intervention. So, identifying risk and tracking the efficacy of therapy if you take a look at the lipidome. Jake, why did this article by Huang et al. Merit publication in Nature Medicine?
I think because it is an extremely high-quality study. So, other people, including present company, have looked at the lipidome in children with obesity and those with steatotic liver disease. But what's different here is they had nearly 1,000 children with obesity and 400 or so who were normal weight, and then did what they describe as deep phenotyping. So they did very detailed examination of the serum lipidome. They also looked at inflammation proteins in the blood. They all had MRI and DEXA body scan for both fat measurement in the liver and their fat distribution. And then in addition, they were able to correlate this with essentially an interventional study where 200 children who were overweight or had obesity were then followed up, and that allowed them demonstrating dynamic changes in these lipid species. So the degree of certainty that we have that these findings are true is substantial compared to probably previous studies.
How is it going to change your practice patterns?
Well, I don't think at this stage it will change practice patterns based on this work alone. I suppose the main implications are that there are certain categories of lipids that seem to dynamically change with weight loss intervention, and then those also correlate with traits that are known to be important. So probably the biggest group to pick out are the triglycerides, and most of the time in clinic we would just measure all triglycerides lumped together. But whilst as a whole they do, as a category, they do move with weight loss. So weight loss, the triglycerides go down, and then that in turn also would correlate with change in ALT, for example. But what they're showing is that, well, that's still quite a crude method. You know, the triglycerides group, it makes up nearly 100 different lipids, at least, depending on how detailed you measure it, probably more like 50-ish. And there are some specific triglycerides that you could measure, which would have a much, much stronger association with obesity in the first place and then dynamic change. So down the line, as techniques for measuring these sorts of molecules become more routine in the lab, would it be possible that rather than measuring all triglycerides, we measure TG580, so 58 is in the carbon chain and zero double bonds, as our main biomarker of response? That is an alternative, because if we're looking into the future when, or if you take, for example, the group of individuals who struggle to lose weight but perhaps are doing more resistance training and gaining muscle mass, and then that they're in a relatively early phase of their intervention, you could perhaps help reinforce a child's or, you know, an adult's exercise or weight loss regime by saying, well, you've got improvement in this blood marker that suggests you're on the right track. Keep going and we'll keep an eye on it.
Oof. It sounds lovely. How far away are we from that?
I think from routine practice, a substantial distance. This sets gives further evidence that there are lipid species that are more strongly associated with cardiometabolic traits, and that they do show dynamic response, and they correlate with important clinical values, insulin, glucose, ALT. But translating them actually into routine practice would be challenging, because at the moment they're measured by mass spectrometry, which is not routinely done for standard lab tests, and then the interpretation of it is often non-automated. So I don't think it's likely to hit the shop floor in the next few years.
Understood. Well, what are the flaws, if you see any, in this study?
Well, as a very, very biased hepatologist, this is a cohort of healthy individuals with obesity or who are overweight in general. So, for example, their mean ALT was 20 in the normal weight group and 24 in the obesity or overweight group. So, subtle elevation. And 15%, only 15% of the overweight group had excess liver fat. And this is quite common in these sorts of studies where they've taken a sort of all-comers group of patients with obesity rather than those who've been specifically referred to a pediatric gastroenterologist, hepatologist. I mean, what I would like to see, and actually this work has been done elsewhere, is if you had a kind of third group of those with children with severe cardiometabolic disease, which could be those with substantial steatotic liver disease or children with very severe forms of insulin resistance, like congenital generalized lipodystrophies, and then you were able to show, for example, you have one or two-fold change from healthy weight to obesity, but then a 10-fold change in the severe category. That would be really elegant, I think.
When are you going to do it?
I mean, we've done a bit of it, but we just didn't do quite such detailed phenotyping of this. I don't know if it has been done in children with severe lipodystrophy before. The caveat I will say for the obesity group is that there clearly was evidence of insulin resistance in that group, even if they didn't have as much end organ injury already. So HOMA-IR is a typical measure of insulin resistance done by a function using fasting insulin and fasting glucose. And that was one, so plumb normal in the healthy group, and three in the obese or overweight group. So it was high, but not crazy high. The other dynamic test that came to mind, which would clearly be a massive undertaking, would be some form of either mixed meal or glucose tolerance test. and then correlating with that. The reason that that is interesting is that changes in your fasting insulin resistant state often occur after changes in your immediate postprandial insulin resistant state. So when someone is in the early phase of developing type 2 diabetes, their body can still respond to the fasting state to maintain normal glycemia. But when they hit their peak glucose concentration immediately after a meal, they don't have enough insulin sensitivity, enough insulin receptors. So that is almost an earlier sign of insulin resistance. And I don't believe that has been done in children, taking a large group of children, giving them glucose tolerance tests and correlating their 20-minute change in glucose or insulin with their plasma lipidome.
Gotcha. Is there anything else about this study that you'd like to bring to our attention?
I think that if you were looking for take-home messages from the lipids, because there's lots of lipids written down, then my sort of top three points would be that almost all the triglycerides are high, as we would in the obesity group, as we would typically expect clinically. And then one of the main trends is that they tend to be more saturated, so fewer double bonds, and then the lipids with more double bonds tend to be negatively associated with the presence of obesity or insulin resistance related traits. And then many of the lipid surface proteins, so the glycerophospholipids, things like lysophosphatid R-choline, is often negatively associated with obesity or insulin resistance. And that probably reflects a change in the size of the lipoparticles, because when you're adjusting for the total amount of lipid, if you have a larger surface area, then that will alter the surface concentration. There hasn't been much discussion of the mechanism in this paper, but those would be my main sort of three summaries of all the lipids that are written down.
Well, thank you. Let's move on toward lateral flow testing. I think all of us learned about lateral flow testing when we were being nasally probed for COVID. Lateral flow testing, quick, easy, a couple of minutes there, sitting and watching and waiting for the transverse line to develop or not to develop. And now this can be used for infliximab?
Apparently so. Probeless, though. So I think this caught my eye, as you say, given our sort of popular familiarity with lateral flow tests. And I think we've discussed several times around infliximab concentrations and dose optimization in IBD. So I thought that this was bringing together two interesting ideas.
Well, go on.
So the overall concept is we want to ensure adequate infliximab concentrations in patients with IBD to maintain and or induce remission, and typically the range of greater than 5 micrograms per milliliter is considered the minimum. And that is measured at the point when the next dose is about to be given, so the trough.
The trough, yes. And that measurement takes about a week to come back from the lab, doesn't it?
Correct, yes. So it takes some time. And that will vary around the globe. A week, the authors quote 2 weeks. So their rationale was, if you could then and there do a lateral flow test to measure the infliximab concentration, would that alter your practice? And
now you'd be running this test because the child had somehow gone sour, gone off, was not responding any longer to the, or seemed clinically not to be responding anymore to the infliximab dose that was being given.
Yes. Well, it depends on how you typically do things. You could measure it in a reactive way, sort of as you described. So the child mm-hmm. develops symptoms of a flare, and then you say, "Oh, well, we should be monitoring the levels." Or I know some places will routinely monitor the infliximab levels at every single infusion, irrespective mm-hmm. of whether mm-hmm. the child is symptomatic or not.
So then you're going to find out how much infliximab is circulating.
Yes.
But you're not going to find out whether it's antibody complex.
Correct. So this is separate from the measurement of infliximab antibodies.
And insensitivity to infliximab, as opposed to, say, failure to take one's infliximab or more rapid metabolism, is something that you're going to have to sort out clinically.
Yeah, this is not a single answer to a simple problem. There are multiple factors playing here.
But if you get the answer while you're still in the doctor's surgery, then that's a lot better than having to wait for 2 weeks. We'll call you and tell you whether or not to come in for some more infliximab.
Yeah, I think it in a very specific group, it could be of benefit. So, for example, if you they basically demonstrated that there was reasonably good correlation between the standard ELISA test and the lateral flow test that was done. Mm-hmm. And that correlation was best in just identifying low versus high level of infliximab, kind of binary yes, no, which is as we would sort of typically do for no from COVID-19 testing. Do you have it? Do you not have it? Mm-hmm. So the kind of clinical group where I could potentially see this being useful is if you had a patient who was currently on 5 milligrams per kilo of infliximab and they had perhaps started to have some subtle symptoms develop and you'd previously measured their infliximab antibodies and knew that they were negative or low, then you could do dose escalation then and there, more or less, if that was possible. Because the other thing that the authors comment on is that in many places, or at least for them, they need 2 weeks between deciding on the dose and the patient getting it.
Hmm.
But I guess it depends on what the infliximab dose bag infusion comes in, whether they're even able to change it on the day. But that's the kind of group that I have in mind where this would be most useful.
Hmm. What problems are there with this study that you've identified?
Well, I mean, the first obvious problem is that the correlation is not perfect between the two. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be the first accuracy element, that it's pretty good, but it's not perfect. And I suppose you want a lab test to be pretty reliable when you're altering the concentration of a very expensive drug based on it.
I'm thinking, so you're going to be running it in duplicate for quite some while anyhow.
Yes.
Lateral flow and ELISA.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it would need further work up to improve the confidence. They've run it on 100 assays here from 21 patients. So 100 sounds like a reasonable number. 21 is a comparatively small number of individuals, I would have said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The population were all individuals who were stable on, who were in sustained remission as part of a randomized controlled trial. So I suppose the plus side is that the patients will have been well characterized and homogenous as that they were in an RCT already. The downside is that what the authors describe as their clinical utility is patients who are sort of needing dynamic changes, but the cohort that they have studied is a cohort who is predominantly stable, or at least that's how they're described to be.
So what they found out is that it works when there's no need for it to work.
I think that they They haven't run formally run a clinical implementation of the test here. They've just run a completely appropriate study of the quality and the reliability of the assay. But I think it's always just worth considering exactly who the samples have come from. It's unclear whether that will affect the validity of the test itself or not.
Righty-ho. Well, it sounds as though, as so often, more work is called for, more funding is called for.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting avenue, and I think that developing new assays that have the ability to do rapid testing is a really good kind of practical implementation of research, and I think that, you know, you just got to keep going with these things.
Well, you crack on, I'll crack on, our listeners will crack on, and we'll have those tests one day. Jake, thank you very much for making yourself available and for leading the discussion here. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks, Alex.